Introduce myself, and I'd like to say hi to all of you. I know a lot of you here, and it's really great that you came over this evening. Such a beautiful evening. I'm Arlene Peterson, and they have me listed as a social worker, but in my work that's kind of ironic because I'm actually a probation officer for Pierce County Juvenile Court here in Washington. It's the Tacoma area, and the irony there is that when the police talk about us, they call us soft-hearted social workers, and when the social workers talk about us, they call us tough cops that, you know we're the other side then. We're law enforcement and we don't have a heart and all that. We're in the middle. So we've always had to be very objective and be very responsible as far as the law is concerned. That's an obligation that we have to deal with, that there is a law and we have to uphold that law. But at the same time, I don't like to think of justice as being totally blind. So I feel that it's just as important that we use some wisdom and discretion in this balance of justice. And so we try to weigh the situation and not always be totally legalistic, but at the same time, we do have that responsibility to uphold the law and to enforce statutes. So, I'm not really a social worker. I sometimes am, and sometimes I'm more of a cop because I have the power to arrest children. So it's a different role. Our subject tonight is children as chattel. And as we get started, I'd like to pass around some pictures of the type of problems that I do work with. Now, we won't discuss these cases tonight. We'll get into more of these type of situations tomorrow, but I thought you might, to get an idea of the type of work we deal with, you might like to, not exactly like or enjoy, but you might be interested in looking at these folders. So I'll pass them around. I'll just start it around and then take the next one. And so you can be glancing at those while I'm talking about the general history of children as chattel. Child abuse isn't new. It's been a continuing thing. It's a traditional thing almost. It's a part of our whole culture, and our entire history reeks of periods of serious, almost depravity as far as our reaction and our attitude toward children. The ancients probably used birth control in a whole different area that we, a whole different means than we do. They would just literally destroy their children if they weren't wanted, and if they had an abundance, they destroyed them. They did this by throwing them in the river, or by religious sacrifices, or the Romans and back in those periods, there's a series of incidents where the youngsters were sold as slaves. And it's always been a tradition to use unwanted boys and girls for prostitution. So it isn't that it's something new. Children have always been terrorized, and they have essentially been treated as chattel, as property. Some of you folks, especially you mature people, older folks have read Pearl Buck's The Good Earth. I don't think the younger people are acquainted with that. But one of the things that stands out in my mind from reading that book is this family that was suffering in this famine sold their infant baby, and at the same time you are made aware of this lavish feast that's going on in a neighbor's home. And that was a wealthy person who bought the child, and they enjoyed that child. That was their dinner that night, and they had this feast. That was one of the things that has stayed with me for many years. History tells us that there was a custom in Naples that I found most interesting, that when a girl child was born, the neighbors would naturally be inclined to come and congratulate the family because of the birth. But if it was a girl child, the family would hang out a black drape so that the neighbors wouldn't be embarrassed by coming and congratulating them on the birth of a child when it turned out to be a girl. So that tells you about the status of women in those days. And another custom that was prevalent back then for thousands of years was swaddling. Plato even talked about swaddling. And he talked in terms of keeping a child bundled for several years, for 2 years, up to 2 years. Other areas in history talk in terms of 40 days to 9 months. And I have a note here from one historian, one writer, an English writer, called Richard Steele, who wrote in 1907 in the Tatler, let me find it here, about the feelings of an infant who was being swaddled. He writes, "I lay very quiet, but the witch, which for no manner of reason or provocation in the world, takes me and binds my head as hard as she possibly could, then ties up both my legs, makes me swallow down a horrible mixture. I thought it an harsh entrance into life to begin with this physic. When I was thus dressed, I was carried to a bedside where a fine young lady, my mother, had liked to give me a big hug and hug me to death, and then threw me into a girl's arms that was taken in to tend me. The girl was very proud of the womanly employment of a nurse and took upon her to strip and dress me anew because I made a noise to see what ailed me. She did so and stuck a pin in every joint about. I still cried, upon which she lay me on my face in her lap, and to quiet me, fell to nailing in all the pins by clapping me on the back and screaming a lullaby." So that was the tender, loving care this newborn infant got, and this was recorded in the Tatler way back in 1706, I should say. There's other areas of abuse beyond this. It's just plain cruelty that was used in the name of development of a child's good behavior and trying to make them be a good citizen. There is one novel by Mrs. Sherwood of England. It's called The History of the Fairchild Family. And she records the children being forced to witness hangings and corpse rotting. Some of the children were taken out of school and they were forced to witness these events, and then they would be whipped to help them remember, so it would be fixed in their mind. And then we have another record of the diary of an 11-year-old girl. She wrote that her father took her to see dead bodies that had been dug up because the cemetery was full and they had to make room for new bodies. And I'd like to read you a little commentary that she wrote. This is a diary that is available. "Papa said it is so foolish and superstitious to be afraid of seeing dead bodies, so I followed him down a dark, narrow, steep staircase that wound round and round a long way till they opened the door into a great cavern. It was lit by a lamp hanging down in the middle, and the friar came, a torch in his hand. At first I could not see, and then I could and hardly dared to look, for on every side there were horrid, black, ghastly figures, some grinning, some pointing at us, or seeming in pain, in all sorts of postures, and so horrid I could hardly help screaming. And I thought they all moved. And when Papa saw how uncomfortable I was, he was not angry, but very kind, and said I must conquer it and go and touch one of them, which was very shocking. Their skin was all dark brown and quite dried up on the bones and quite hard and felt like marble." Now here you have a picture of a father who thought he was being very responsible and doing a kind thing and helping his child through a very difficult time. But this was a horrendous time for her. That's the type of thing that the ancients implored. Of course, we can come to more current periods, and we remember, we've all studied Dickens, and you think about what the children went through in Dickens, about the groups of robber children, and about the conditions and how they were pretty well sold off and given to other people. We know about the Industrial Revolution, which we all pride, we take a lot of pride in, because it has made us a civilized nation with all these advantages, both in England and the United States. But when you study the record of the Industrial Revolution, you find that much of their manpower was children, and these children were from age 6 on up. They had to work 12 to 16 hours a day. They were literally tied to machines. And I, in my research a few years ago, I came across a record of testimony in the Massachusetts legislature where they were trying to outlaw this kind of child labor, where industrialists admitted that they tied children to the machines, and it really didn't matter if they died because there were always more out there to take their place. And of course, the parents were so poorly paid, and families were large, and survival was so difficult that they had to utilize their entire workforce. And so, if a child was old enough to be out walking and be around and be at all able to go, he was forced to go out and earn his own board and keep. And the children died by the dozens. We think of the poor children in the South, the black children who were slaves and had to be out in the cotton fields, but in studying this, it dawned on me that probably they were more fortunate than those in the North who were in the factories, because they were dark and bleak and ill-fed, and at least the Southern children got some sunshine and fresh air. In our civilized America, we find in history that we brought many children from England as indentured children to provide labor for the colonies. I wasn't aware of that until I came. Our history doesn't tell us how great we are. And it's until you start digging, really digging, and getting into some of this history that you find these things. And those kids, those six-year-olds, were then used by merchants and farmers in the whole countryside for labor. And they didn't have a 40-hour week. They worked 12 or 16 hours a day. Finally, if a boy survived till he was 12 or 14, he would be allowed then to apprentice. And so he could hire himself out then. And so the money he made wasn't automatically turned over to the family. He'd have the right to go out and fend for himself. But of course, that wasn't an easy life either. He was literally a slave until he became old enough to be out on his own and fend for himself. Finally, there was one faint ray of hope for children in 1647, when Massachusetts required that children be educated. They didn't really do it for the child. They did it because of the emphasis on religion, and they were forced to go to school then to learn to read the Bible. That was the purpose of education back then, but that was one faint hope. During that period also, these were very, very firm, just people who settled our country, and they didn't have jails. They didn't believe in jails. They believed in punishment and that type of discipline. So rather than jails, they used public stocks, and they used branding and hanging. And this was an open air type discipline, and this applied to children as well as adults, so there was no difference. We progressed in our society to prisons, and of course in the prisons included everybody, men, women, and children in one prison. And so you can see what the kids went through there. And they had no trials, or they didn't have a probation officer or anybody to speak for them. They had to survive somehow. So as our society progressed on, finally people began to recognize that injustice. And New York and Massachusetts back in 1825 and 1826, back in those periods, did build houses of refuge. They were virtually prisons for children, but at least they were separated from the adults. So you have that history. Then we had a really progressive event in 1848. There was a Dr. Sam Howe in Massachusetts who felt that these kids in the cities were really disadvantaged and needed help and needed other opportunities. So he tried to treat children who were in trouble or who were normally imprisoned. So he established this home for children out in the farming community. But of course, the farmers were suspicious and very reluctant to deal with a youngster that might have had some problem or broken the law or done something, anything. And so they wouldn't be involved in this at all. So his experiment failed. During this period, too, we have another period of great pride in our country when we moved west. We moved to the west with the wagon trains and the big push west. But who needs children on a wagon train? Who needs 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 year olds on a wagon train that might get sick and need food and fuss and cry and take up room? We have history that records that there were as many as 2,000 of these abandoned children wandering the streets of New York City. And it was largely as the parents moved west with the wagon train. These kids ran in packs in New York City, like dog packs, you know, and tried to survive. And if they didn't survive, it was over. But if they survived, they must have been very, very strong people. So that's another period of real pride in our nation, in our growth. But about this time, there was one event that was hopeful. Another Dr. Howe, this was a different one, but out in Ohio, established the Ohio State Reform School. He implemented a program of behavioral mod, of socialization, and he used cottage plans. Instead of just throwing these kids into a mass jungle, he broke them into groups and made it a more home-like situation. This wasn't readily adapted, but at least it was a step. It was one area of progress in this business of children as chattel. And a little later, in 1863, Chicago established a reform school. That was another step. Very limited, but at least it was an effort to remove children from the prisons and to give them a place to go when they were abandoned, that type of thing. However, about this time, there was a very significant incident. A boy was arrested and thrown into this reform school. And so the parent protested this because the child wasn't tried and he wasn't specifically charged or convicted with anything. This case was called People versus Turner. And it essentially dealt with the parents patriae approach to juvenile justice versus constitutional rights. Now the parents patriae system deals with a benevolent father approach, where the judge sits as father and he does what he feels is in the best interest of his child. Okay, he might not give the child rights, just like at home. We don't always read him his rights and say, you can have an attorney and all that. We deal with the situation as we see fit. But this judge, so the judge is supposed to respond that way as a benevolent father with the very best interests of the child at heart. But it doesn't always work that way. Many times judges are prejudiced or they have a hang-up about a certain behavior, or the probation officer or the local police officer gets to him and says, you got to do something with that kid. And so the judge responds, and so the child isn't always treated the way he should be, fairly. And he certainly has not had his constitutional rights. This happened in Illinois. This boy was 15 years old, as I said, and committed to that reform school. He hadn't been convicted. And so the court looked at this case and said that since there was no proof of guilt, the juvenile should be released and that juveniles were entitled to protection commensurate with adults. Well, that was never really adapted as a new policy, and so that progress was quickly reversed when in 1899 Illinois adopted a Juvenile Court Act. Now this act separated juveniles from adults. It gave them their own court system. And that was a whole new approach. Before that, they were always involved in the court system one way or another. Police would throw them in jail, and if they ever went to court, which was rare, I'm sure, they would be handled in the adult court. This act came about by a group of women in New York who were incensed at the way children, or in Illinois, I should say, who were incensed at the way children had been handled, and just pushed and pushed until they got the bill implemented. It required that children be housed in facilities separate from adults. It required that there be an emphasis on probation for children, that they not always necessarily be removed from the home, but that somebody go out in the community and work with them, and that they have a trial by jury. And this part of it was never implemented. In studying this, I found that they probably included this trial by jury to protect the constitutionality of it, because that's what adults have. And so this was a guise to provide for a constitutional right of a child to have the same privileges as an adult. But it was never adapted, and to this day, like in our state, we don't have jury trials for children. And many states don't. There are some that do now. However, this did, again, reaffirm this parents' patriae system, in which the judge sits as the benevolent father, and where you don't have to worry much about a child's rights, about his rights in comparison to an adult's rights. Washington State adapted this bill this approach in 1905, and by 1925 most states had juvenile court systems. This approach, this 1899 approach of the parents patriae and the juvenile court system, continued right up until 1966. And 1966 and 67 were momentous years in our court system, in our juvenile work. There were some earth-shaking decisions at that time. We have a case known as the Kent case. Are any of you familiar with that at all? Anybody who's studied SOCH very much probably dealt with that. Okay. In this case, a 16-year-old boy was arrested and charged with rape. He had been involved in the court system 2 years prior because of some burglaries, but at that time he was placed on probation. Okay, when he was charged with rape, his probation officer, or whoever was dealing with him, went to the judge and told him what was going on and about the boy's behavior, and you know, he's in trouble. And the judge transferred him to adult status. He had no fact-finding hearing. He had no opportunity to have an attorney represent him or to present any psychiatric or psychological testimony. He was literally at the mercy of the judge, and so the judge transferred him to adult status. That matter was then taken to the Supreme Court, and they overruled it. This was Abe Fortas was at that time the presiding Supreme Court judge, and he felt very strongly about this situation. He said that let's find this here. He said that as a condition he was talking in terms of the injustice to the child, And he said this child was entitled to a valid petition, to a hearing. He was entitled to access to a counsel. He was entitled to have that counsel have an opportunity to read his records and his probation information. And that generally, this child had not been given the same rights as an adult. And Justice Fortas was very angry about this, and he said that the child receives the worst of both worlds, that he gets neither the protections accorded to adults nor the solicitous care and regenerative treatment postulated for children. He said that from now on it would be imperative that he be entitled to bail, any child, speaking in terms of children generally, that they be entitled to bail, to indictment by grand jury, to a speedy and public trial, to trial by jury, to immunity against self-incrimination, to confrontation of his accusers, and to counsel. So he really came down on this traditional juvenile court system. That didn't change everything immediately, but it was a first impact. A year later, in 1967, the Galt case was heard by the Supreme Court. Are you familiar with that, anyone? That case originated in Arizona, and it was a situation where a 15-year-old boy was arrested because he had made an obscene phone call. He was arrested without the knowledge of his parents. There was a hearing held the following morning, but there were no formal charges pressed. And he never had an opportunity to confront his accuser. And so at that hearing, the judge just took a recess and he said he'd think about it for a few days. Well, then there was a new hearing date set, but again, it wasn't formally done. There were no official charges or legal petition filed. The parents weren't aware of their rights. The child wasn't aware of any rights he might have. And as a result of that second hearing, the child was found guilty, and he was committed to their school of detention, their industrial school in Arizona, until his majority. Now that would be 21 years. That would mean 6 years because he made an obscene phone call, which nobody had ever found him guilty of making. An adult in that situation would have been fined $50 and given 6 months or something like that, a very minimal fee were he convicted. So there you have that inconsistency between a child and adult. As a result of that hearing, the courts throughout the land sat up and take notice, because then it was ruled that notices of charge must be legally served. This notice must include the time, date, place, and charge in specific detail. The accused has a right to counsel and should be appointed counsel if he cannot afford an attorney, especially if the decision involved being committed to a state institution. He was entitled to the right to cross-examine and confront his accuser. He also is protected against self-incrimination, and he need not testify against himself. And also a transcript of the trial and any information or pertinent information must be made available to counsel in representing a youngster like that. I remember when this happened at Reman Hall, where I work. The place shook. Everybody just didn't know what was going to happen next, because it had been a loose, lax way of dealing with kids. And a probation officer today still has a lot of responsibility, but we have a lot of guidelines and lots of rules that we have to respond to. We have limits. In those days, you could do almost anything. And a child was pretty much pretty much at your mercy. And so things have changed since then. With that decision, a lot of strides were taken, but I can remember this one youth officer, this one child guidance officer, that he's a fine man, and I've worked with him for many years, and he just thought about it for a minute, and he said, "Oh yeah, I can see me bouncing this 8-year-old on my knee while I'm reading him his rights," which is true too. You know, you have that 8-year-old that goes out and sets a fire or steals somebody's bicycle, and you still have to read him his rights. And then I have this happen all the time where I might read a child his rights, and sometimes several times, and the youngster will say, "Oh, do I have to listen to that again? They read them to me yesterday." You know? And I always say, "Yes, you do," because one time I took a youngster to court. She had confessed to me and another probation officer and signed a statement that she had stolen $80 out of a teacher's purse. Well, that's a serious crime. But we got in court, and because I had not read her rights, the police officer had, and I had a copy of that in the file, but I had not read her rights at the time that she gave me this information. The petition was dismissed, and she went home. And I learned fast, so I read them their rights when I'm dealing with these youngsters. So I've explored it quite a bit here. What about questions? How do you all feel about all this information? Who's got any questions?
I'd like to ask a situation. I don't know how close this is to to children as chattel, but it is my understanding that that a large portion, at least maybe somewhere 60% of crimes nowadays are committed by children mm-hmm. under the age of 16 or something of this sort. I don't know the exact.
It's more like 50%, and you're right, under the age of 18.
Well, at any rate, whatever it is, it seems that there is special immunity granted to children, so much so that I, as a member of society, wonder if society, the pendulum hasn't swung the other direction, too mm-hmm. far the other direction, and now society is going to have to start protecting itself from the children.
Right. I agree with you. I can cite a very appropriate incident, a very apt incident. I was working with, I think I told somebody about this here recently, but I was working with some boys. They had been involved with stealing cars, and they had come across a set of keys in a gravel pit. You know, there were trucks parked there, and they found these keys, and they found out that one of those keys would fit old Ramblers and old Volkswagens. So they had a ball. They'd go out late at night and early in the morning when the folks are sleeping, and they'd find all these old 65 and 66 and 64 Ramblers and VWs. These keys would work, and they would take them and just go out in the community and have a ball. Play chicken, you know, run over these rows of mailboxes out in the county, pass your car and whip the door open and gouge out the side and go on. They just really had a good time. There were about 8 of them in this group before we caught them, and they got stopped. Well, I was working with one boy who was going to turn 18 in 2 months, and I talked to him about his responsibility in this, and he said, "Do you mean that taking a 65 Volkswagen out of a parking lot is auto theft?" And I said, "What else?" And I agree with you. Too many of our youngsters don't realize that the law applies to them, and they're going to have to stand as an adult if they want to play that kind of game. But they have the same responsibility as an adult. And so we do have to weigh this very carefully. Kids also kind of have the idea that if they get involved in something, now burglaries are the big thing. Smoking pot isn't a big deal anymore. Everybody smokes pot, so it's not a big status thing anymore. But burglaries are, and that's where that crime rate that you're talking about is coming from. And it is not a deprived youngster that's out burglarizing. It's your kid and my kid. They get into it, and their friend challenges them, and they get away with one, and it's exciting. It's a challenge. It's stimulating. And so then they find another one that they can rip off, and they get into that. And if they aren't caught, they can end up burglarizing 12 or 13 or 15 or 20 houses. We had one recently where they had burglarized 30. And they were not deprived children. They were people of the community, good kids, you know. But they don't realize that's a crime, and they get into it, and it's kind of exciting, and we have let them get away with too much.
How can the parents know, though?
That's right.
Keep track of them.
You can't. It's a value system, and personally, I feel that part of our problem is television and things the kids are exposed to these days. Many parents are too protective, and the first thing a parent will say is, "My boy wouldn't do that. You know, that's not my boy. He wouldn't do that. He told me he didn't do it." And then we have to deal with that and say, "Well, your boy is embarrassed to admit to you, you know, that he did it, and that's why he's lying, but he admitted it to the police officer." You know, or go home and look and check out things, you know, and find out, are there some strange items in your house that you can't account for? They bring in records, they bring in stereos and speakers and things like that, and say, "Well, my friend is loaning it to me. You know, it's my buddy's skis," this kind of thing. And parents don't always know, but that's one of the responsibilities we have to deal with. Yes?
I think one of the key things there is that it's much easier for parents to realize their children's problems if they will admit to their own errors.
True.
I found I have a younger sister who is extremely juvenile delinquent and years of it. And my parents were very realistic about it because they realized their own problems in just making mistakes themselves. And that was one of the things that I really appreciated about them in dealing with it, was the fact that they you know, didn't accuse her of lying, but they never once said, "Oh, my daughter would do that."
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that that's kind of a...
That's really important, that you do face up if that sort of thing happens, that you do face up and try to work with that and make the child be responsible and help him. My own contention is that you should never desert a child or make him feel unwanted, but make him know that he has to stand up, but you will stand there with him and support him and help him through. And if he knows that, then from then on, I think you've made the grounds for you and for him.
That almost sounds like a condoning attitude.
No, it isn't. No, you stand there and face the medicine. You have to take this and face up. But I'm not deserting you because you made a mistake and you got in trouble. You're still my son, you're still my daughter, and I love you.
That I accept. I think, again, that's okay. Realize that you got into trouble, but the reason you got in trouble, I also got to get into trouble too. That's almost an accepting or a condoning situation.
Oh, it is in a sense, I suppose, but I think that there's growth there, a development of a strong relationship, and many times a child, he is so frightened of his parents finding this out because he's afraid he'll be abandoned by him. And if he knows, if he learns that they're going to stand by him, not try to get him off, but stand by him and make him stand up and face this. Yes?
I wanted to ask now, in the case of this theft ring that a juvenile,
mm-hmm.
how old are the fences or the people who buy these? What kind of punishment are they vulnerable to? Greater than the ones who steal them, I would hope.
Okay, and the...
Also, how about the people, the good citizens, who buy these bargains from kids?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What kind of, you know, how vulnerable are they to punishment?
Well, I can give you a specific example there. One of the boys I was working with this past year was involved in not stealing the cars. They stole one. They were out for kicks, and they found this four-wheel drive jobby, and they decided that it'd be fun. So they took that for a spin, but they didn't damage it or anything, so they were very fortunate. But they did, in the process of their prowling, car prowling, they took like $2,000 worth of items, stereos, tires, and they came across this one car. Somebody left $1,500 worth of camera equipment in the back of that VW, and whoever would do that is not quite thinking very well. And so they sold one of these cameras to like a sister's boyfriend, you know. Well, when we started to unravel this situation, we found out who had the camera, and the police went and talked to him. And usually what happens is that the police will make them very uncomfortable. They don't normally arrest them, but they make them very uncomfortable and pretty embarrassed about the whole thing and get it back. But that's about the extent of it. They don't usually prosecute them. Now, you asked me something before that about the kids.
Well, just what is usually the age of the parents?
Oh, the age.
And the ones who will take drugs from these kids, encourage them, and what kind of vulnerability are they to find?
The age is just people, anybody. It can
over,
be...
Over the youth age.
Yeah, it's usually an adult, but there's no limit as far as the age of that adult. We had another situation where I worked with this boy, and he was involved in going out and burglarizing homes, but actually taking furniture, and then he took the furniture to a secondhand store. And that was the fence. And so, and that was a mature man, but he was involved in this, and that's how he could have such good deals in his in his operation. And there's much of that goes on. We had one situation that I worked with where this very intelligent boy, he's one of my favorite kids I've worked with, because once we got through this, he got it, his act together, and he whipped through school and he learned his lesson, and I'm sure he moved out of the state, but I'm sure he's in college and doing well now, a fine young man. But he got involved in this, and it was a situation where some servicemen would go out and be involved with people in the community, you know, a girlfriend, and got acquainted with other people, and so they would check out a home situation and then clue these boys in on what they had there and what they should take, and then the boys went in and did the burglary for them. Now you're dealing with adults there, you know, and the boys were vulnerable enough to respond to this. And as far as the kids doing it, it ranges from anywhere from 12 on up. You will get a 12-year-old. In fact, we had one very unique situation where we had a little 12-year-old girl who was the brains of the outfit. Very charming little gal. Just a sweetheart. She was lovely, and she could just charm the socks off of you. And she and her little brother had this little thing going, where she'd go up to a house and ring the doorbell and very innocently say, "Have you seen my little brother? He was playing out here before and I'm looking for him." Well, if they answered the door, then she knew they were home, so she went away. But or else she would talk her way in, and they'd want to talk to her a little bit, and she'd go in and kind of size it up and see what they had in there, and then when she left, she and her brother would come back later. And they took some things until they got caught. They broke into a number of homes that way. If nobody answers the door, you know they aren't there, you see. And if they do answer, you're very innocent. And this sweet little girl, of course, nobody's going to be suspicious of her. And she and her little brother had this little thing going for a while. The youngest, while we're on this, the youngest burglar that I ever worked with was 3 years old. Now that is a unique story. There were two couples, and they each had a child, and this one couple used their little child. They would jimmy a window open or something, put their child in and then tell her where the front door was, and she'd go in and lock, open the front door for them. And she was kind of proud of that. So you can understand what type of a situation she was growing up in, and that was really pathetic because she, I took her out to a private home. We don't lock little three-year-olds up. We take them to private homes, and they're cared for. And I took her out to this private home, and on the way I was chatting with her and trying to figure out everything she'd been involved in. And she said, "I broke into your house." And I said, "Oh, you wouldn't steal anything from me." And she said, "Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I broke into your house." And so then she started telling me about it. My daddy opened the window and he put me in there and I broke into your house. And she was really proud of this, and it was so pathetic. It wasn't my home, but it was someone's. Yeah, you had it. Okay.
Well, when we lived in Chicago, we had some rather interesting and frequent contacts with a street gang called the Blackstone Rangers for a number of years. And we're very frustrated in working with the law to deal with these kinds of crimes because the law did not seem to have any provision for dealing with group crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the gang did the damage, and to pinpoint the one person who threw the Molotov cocktail or who did the damage was very difficult. And even if you did pinpoint the person who did the damage, the rest of the gang was there for retaliation, so you were very careful how you dealt with it. Has anything improved in this regard?
I don't think so. I think the only thing you can do there is fall back on David Wilkerson type people and people who are willing, your type of people who are out there working with them and hope that you can reach them one way or another. Those things are difficult because the thing is if they bring them in and they're out the next day because you can't prove anything on anybody, they're laughing all the way home. And then you really look ridiculous. You have to be, that's one situation that police are really in a difficult position, because if they arrest these kids, the kid is a hero, and when he comes running out because you can't charge him with anything or convict him with anything, he's a big man in that area, and they go on. It's very difficult. I don't know how effective your police were, of course, but I'm sure that they had that problem. There's not much you can do. It's hard, and it's difficult for us. Very often the police are frustrated with us because they bring a youngster in and they might know he did something, but you don't have any proof. And that's the other side of this, you see, the things I've been talking about is that you can know a youngster is guilty or been involved and needs help, and the best thing for him would be to get him out of that situation. But you can't legally do it, and you have to send him home and wait for something worse to happen. And that's sad. We come up against that all the time. It's very frustrating. Yeah?
What is the procedure that is followed in investigating a report of child abuse? My mom is a school teacher in Tacoma, and
she's
in contact with suspected child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of procedure do you follow to investigate?
Okay, I'm involved with a group called the Panel for Family Living. We work a lot in working with the parents who abuse the children, because if you can't improve the situation at home, you can never send that child back. And so it's a tense situation there. You try to help the parents get their act together so that you can send the child back. We have put on seminars there. I hope maybe your mom would get interested in coming to the next one we put on in the schools for teachers to make them aware of the child abuse problems and situations. But to answer your question directly, the Children's Protective Services. Now that's one area I didn't discuss in my little presentation here. Children just never had any rights, as you gathered. Well, back in 100 years ago, there was an Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And at that time, there was this situation in Philadelphia where a child was chained to a bed. The neighbors knew it, and they were appalled, so they called the police, and the police couldn't do anything. There was no law to protect children. So in an effort to resolve this and get that child out of there, the neighbors banded together and hired an attorney. The attorney took this matter to court and had to prove that that child, that little Mary Jane, who was 8 years old, was an animal, so that they could utilize the laws for protection of animals. That was where CPS was born. As a result of that, then, there is a subdivision of the American Association for Protection of Cruelty to Animals. It's the American Association for Protection of Cruelty to Children. It's a subdivision of the Humane Society. I belong to that. And I've been paying dues in that organization for years, and all I do is pay dues, and I know that money is being used to develop more programs, more CPS programs, and more child abuse awareness, and resolve these things. But finally, a year or so ago, or a few months ago it was, started getting the American Humane Association magazine, and I was surprised, and it was because the American Humane Association finally recognized that that those of us who were supporting the children's end of this group had never had any representation, or we never got anything. And so finally they came on board and recognized this too, even though this has been a valid partnership for many years. And the president of the American Humane Association is Joe Betzendorfer, and he's an attorney who lives in Tacoma. So the next time I saw him, I said, "You're finally realizing that there's some of us who deal with children and it isn't all just animals." And he said that from now on, every issue, one issue would be dedicated to animals and one to children. So we're coming on board in more ways than one. But anyway, the Children's Protective Society grew out of this American Humane Association program. And now there's we call them CPS, and there's a CPS office in every major community. It's generally tied in with the DSHS, Department of Social and Health Services, in your community. So if you have a call, you either call them, in your mother's case, it would be CPS. If it's an emergent situation in the middle of the night or something like that, or you can't get a hold of a CPS worker, you call the police and they can go in and do something. If it's emergent and that child is in immediate danger, then they will respond and pick up the child. At least that's how we work in this state. I don't know how other states are. I don't normally go out and pick up children. It's usually done by CPS or the police.
What are the legal implications for the people who do the reports?
In our state, they're protected. I was involved in writing the Child Abuse Reporting Act for Washington State 2 years ago. I might tell you about the original one. One of the CPS workers went and spoke to a high school class at Stadium High School in Tacoma. And the kids, this was a law class. And so she got talking about it and said what a dire need there was for a good reporting bill requiring that people report child abuse. And so that class sat down and wrote the first bill that we had in Washington State. And they got it passed and implemented. So that was our first one. Well, it had a few loopholes in it, so 2 years ago we started rewriting it, and a group of us got together, and we had to accommodate from far right to far left. We had everybody included in helping formulate this thing, from John Birchers to American Civil Liberties Union. So we did come up with a bill that protects anyone who reports in our state. Someone else, you?
I know that the state reporting laws differ from state to state. Mm-hmm. What is your feeling? Now, I know in the state of Wisconsin, only certain people are required by law under state statute to report abuse, and that's physicians, nurses, social workers, teachers,
yeah.
And I know this differs from state to state. Many states are trying to get laws through that would require any citizen, regardless of your occupation or whatever, to report. What is your personal feeling?
Well, our law is similar to that. It requires those people who deal on a broad scope with children to report if they suspect. Now, does yours say if they suspect?
If they suspect, and they are given immunity under law, too.
Good.
But some states have adopted laws where every citizen, they don't distinguish. Every citizen is required by law, and I don't think there's very many of them yet. But I wondered what your feeling was in terms of having a bill like that as opposed to making the distinction.
Well, it's fine, but sometimes these things can be abused too, and you don't want a neighbor who's out to get another neighbor calling up because that mother ran down to the store and bought a pound of sugar, you know. There are situations where people can abuse that and harass other people with it, and so we're concerned about that too, but I would have no problem with that, none at all. We are concerned that sometimes relatives do this to another relative, and we always have to deal with that. We get phone calls, and I'm separated from my wife. This is a common one. I'm separated from my wife, and she's living with that guy, and she's out, and blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on. And so immediately you have to be very careful because you know he's out to get her. And you have to be very careful before you jump in and start accusing anybody of child abuse, because you have to recognize that overall hostility that's there and how one person is trying to undercut the other person.
Is there a penalty for failure to report?
It's a felony in Washington now for failure to report. Years ago, we could never even get doctors to report. It's still very difficult. They would deny. I had a situation where a little 2-month-old baby had a spiral fracture in the leg of the leg. Okay, that was out at Madigan Hospital. That's an Army hospital. And we got the report of this, and this was a doctor out there who insisted that that child could have received this injury by falling off a bed onto a thick carpet. And we said, no, you know, no way. It's a spiral fracture. Something was twisted and turned to make that type of an injury. And so we wouldn't back off. It was a very pathetic case because I finally got the young father and the young mother in my office. The boy was 17 years old in the Army. He had an 18-year-old wife. He was in trouble with the Army for being AWOL. She was sitting in a motel room by herself, an isolated young girl, lonely and lost and frightened. And she would call up the post to find out if he had been court-martialed yet. She didn't know what was going to happen. A very pathetic story. They were from Salt Lake City. Hi. And they got in my office, and she admitted that just in talking with her that she had been so upset and so distraught that afternoon because she didn't know what was happening with him, and she was alone, and the baby was fussing and crying and carrying on, and finally she picked up the baby and just flipped it against the wall. And then when he came home, at least he had enough sense of responsibility to know something was seriously wrong and to take the child back to the hospital. So it was a very tragic thing, but they admitted it. But this doctor insisted that that child could have received this injury by falling on the rug. We do have a difficult time with doctors often. They're getting better, though. If we can educate them a little more, we have hope. Also, they don't like to be involved because some of them feel like, I am here to treat. I'm here to treat this person, not to judge him. Well, it's sad to think of treating a child and sending him home and having him back in a month or maybe 2 weeks with another injury. And you have to take more responsibility than that, and we're finally making doctors very aware of that. Now Madigan is working with us very closely, and our relationship with them has improved tremendously. We've done a lot of work out there, and things are changing.
What happened to a little child like this, to the parents? Do they lose their child?
Well, this was...
There is so much,
yeah.
You know, that could happen. In this case, the mother was violent.
This case...
There are so many cases where, you've got to protect the child, but you've got to protect the parents. You've got to not protect the parents, but you've got to teach them.
Help them.
If they've
mm-hmm.
never been
Help
taught.
Them. Yeah.
Somebody has to... I'm working with a girl that, 35, with two little children. That mm-hmm. one has just been taken away for abuse. But you walk up to that girl and you just touch her lovingly on the arm and say, Ruth, you know, I want something, and she jumps. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the mother.
Yeah.
And when she's been treated like this,
mm-hmm. that's right.
How can you expect? You know, and she says so pathetically, I can't spank my own kids, but the social worker can drag them by the arm down the alley on the belly with her scratched leg to get her away from my house, you know. And she loves the children, mm-hmm. and she's never been taught differently.
That's right. Established in Tacoma, the Panel for Family Living has done a great deal along that line in making our community aware of the need that parents have, and that we have to help rehabilitate those parents. And in our program there, this is separate from the court, we had received a grant for $100,000 from HEW as a test, as an exemplary program. And we had established a number of programs to deal with that. You have education classes where you teach basic parenting skills, expectations and child development and all that. We had group sessions where parents would come together and realize that they're not the only ones that feel frustrated with their children and their life and their situation. And other people have the same problems, and therefore when you recognize that you're not alone, and maybe somebody's even worse than you are, you can start improving and working, dealing with that. We tried to help them resolve the other problems that would trigger the abuse. I hope to talk about more of this tomorrow. Maybe dad's in the army and he's gone all the time, and there she is left with this sick child and these screaming kids and nobody to help her, no friends, no lifeline. We talk in terms of a lifeline. We also would, if the case was serious enough and it was a very personal situation where this person had some psychological problems, we would get them involved in that type of therapy, regular therapy, or in marital counseling or whatever. But we had a unique program there that most agencies don't have, and that was a parent aid program where we would find a friend, like any one of you people, who would work with this person who was lonely and upset and had all these problems, but not be judgmental. Be a friend, be supportive. Give them a break when they need to get out of the house for a change, or take them out shopping or out to lunch once in a while, and just be a friend without laying a judgment trip on them. I have to do that as a probation officer. The CPS worker has to do it. Law enforcement has to do it. We have this obligation, so we cannot come in as that supportive friend. We can be supportive, but we can't really pick up that role. So we would tie in, like I could see any one of you filling this role with one of these parents. Be their friend. And that has been very effective there. So we have several programs like that going. They are essential. I have one of the key roles in my life now is working with this program. And we're in trouble now because our funding ran out and we have to get refunded. And we've been very successful because we have not tied into another agency. We haven't associated ourselves with a hospital you know, tied onto it and been under the hospital regulations or anything, or to a college or to any social services unit at all, because we wanted this flexibility and be able to integrate programs that we felt would really be workable and necessary, and we've done it. But because we did it, we're in trouble because we don't have a sponsoring, you know, a fairy godmother looking out for us now. So we're right now fighting like crazy to get some funds to keep going. Yes?
I don't know if it's a local program, but anyway, the Spokane television channel has spot announcements and with a number to call if you're having problems, if you need help, if your children are bugging you, call this number.
Yeah, a crisis, kind of a crisis intervention thing. That's so important. Crises are one of the factors in abusive situation. Right offhand, as we talk, I keep thinking of cases. And right offhand, I think of this one little gal. She was an Indian girl who was pregnant by a man who all of a sudden left her high and dry, decided they weren't going to get married, and she had counted on getting married. She had two other children, and here she is pregnant with this child. She had this little boy, rambunctious little boy, and she was giving him breakfast, and he spilled a bowl of cereal. Well, that's happened to all of us. Everybody knows about it and how frustrated you are. She cleaned it up, gave him another bowl. He spilled that one too, and that did it. And she grabbed a high heel shoe and just walloped him. And but there again, she loved her child, and she realized this was a serious situation, and she had the presence of mind to go out and yell for help, and she did. So neighbors came and got him to the hospital, and he was fine. It was just a laceration. It could have been more serious. But it was just that crisis situation. She had all these problems. She was deserted. Nobody was there to help her, support her, and she lost her cool. And the child is the most vulnerable person, and that's the one that gets it. You know. But that crisis intervention is so important, and we use that technique too. We have the, every now and then you hear the spot announcements. And it's really, really important that, that people be made aware of that, that there is a place to go for help. Yeah. Do we have other questions?
I wondered about the back of the crime. Is there any statistics on the teenage, well, say the burglaries or anything of that nature? What? How many of those children are left alone? Those adolescents are left alone. In the case such as both parents working and they're not home by the time the child gets home from school, yeah.
I don't know if I don't think we have statistics on that, but I don't really see that as the answer. You cannot babysit a 14, 15, 16-year-old boy every minute, or girl. They have got to have some freedom and some mobility and some flexibility. And if you're going to just watch them every minute and guard them, they're going to grow up to be very disturbed, unstable youngsters.
Probably very sneaky.
Very sneaky. Yeah, the sneaking out is a good. That happens all the time. So I don't see that as the answer. I think our value systems have got to be established in a youngster that it's wrong to break into somebody's house. It's wrong to steal somebody's car. And kids have gotten away from that. I started talking about this before and then I sidetracked myself a little bit. But when you watch television, it's always some kind of creepy, strange person that gets convicted. He's very obviously sick or weird or something, and he gets convicted. You never see a nice, good person get convicted.
Cheerleader.
Right. You never see that. You never see a neat person, a child or adult, like one of us, get convicted. Because there's always a shrewd attorney, or it's just not a good, wholesome person. And to me, it's kind of established in our kids' minds that us good people aren't really bad. And that I'm a good person, you know, a child thinks, I'm really a good guy, I'm not a bad guy, I'm not one of those creepy people that you see on television. And so people like me never have to worry about this kind of thing, and so we never deal with the fact that we might be guilty of something and may someday have to pay a price. And maybe that's a vague philosophical approach, but I see that more and more with the kids that I work with, that they can't identify with being a criminal at all, because they're good, basically good people.
I think another thing too is what I see you doing and having done in the past also that I agree with is the fact that the people such as yourself confront it. You know, you honestly question it, you talk about it, mm-hmm. whereas so often parents sidestep it. They're so
yes.
afraid
yeah.
to really ask.
Yeah.
And they hint, you know, but they don't really ask those honest mm-hmm. questions.
Where were you yeah. last night?
Or,
well, I was over to somebody's house.
Because so often
yeah.
if they do, sometimes, you know, the adolescent, the teenager, whatever, will think, you know, they're asking me a genuine question.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be shocked, although, sometimes into saying the truth.
I think you're right about that. I think we can't be so frightened of our children that they might not love us anymore if we question them and make them be responsible. And many parents are so threatened by their children. If I make him be responsible or face up to something, he might not love me anymore. And that's a terrible way to feel. That's terrible, because most of the kids that I work with really want limits. They want somebody to care enough to stop them, to say, look, I'm not going to let you hurt yourself. You know, I love you too much for that. And if you want to stand there and scream at me and call me a lot of dirty names and use all the four-letter words, that's fine, but you're not going to do this. But that's a very threatening thing for parents, that my child might not love me anymore if I make him stand up. Yes?
Well, I was just going to say, I think parents have been brainwashed with the idea that if you do question them, that you're not trusting.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That whole idea of
yeah.
trust.
Yeah. I think kids are always after this freedom. I want more freedom. And probably one of the most tired lines I've used in working with kids is that with freedom comes responsibility. And for every step of freedom you have two steps of responsibility. And kids can't quite understand that, but I'm sure you all do. It takes a while to make them realize that. But parents have to do that from day one. You know, if you want to go play at Johnny Jones's house, then you be home on time and you behave yourself and you do what you're expected to do. And if you don't, you don't get to go there. It's that simple. It's consequences of philosophy. Well, thank you for all the good questions. I hope I see a lot of you tomorrow. We're going to talk about more of this. 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. I'd love to have you all here.